Welcome back to the Multicultural Middle Ages. I'm your host today, Jonathan Correa Reyes, and I am joined by members of the Medievalist Toolkit, Alice Grissom, Benjamin Bertrand, and Robin Reich. Today we will be discussing the work of the Medievalist Toolkit, medievalisms, and the importance of public outreach for medievalists. So, to get us started, could I ask you to describe the Medievalist Toolkit? What is the work you do and what is your mission as you understand it? Robin, as one of the founding members, maybe you can get us started.
So the Medievalist Toolkit started among a interdisciplinary graduate cohort of medievalists at Columbia University, kind of initially in response to the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally in 2017. I think we, like a lot of medievalists around that time, felt that was kind of a call to action. We were very motivated to not just think about how the Middle Ages is being invoked in the present, but also how we can better educate the public about the Middle Ages and about the history of its use in the modern period. So that is essentially our mission. We study uses of the Middle Ages in the modern world and work with a variety of professionals in a bunch of different industries to educate people about it.
Who is your target audience?
Now, mainly, we work with other university-level educators. We work with K-12 educators. We work with social workers. And we're sort of trying to branch into other varieties of people who are medieval-inspired, other public outreach or public humanities organizations like museums, as well as, honestly, hobbyists and social groups that are kind of drawing inspiration from the Middle Ages. I will say, I think very early on, we had this more kind of activist pipe dream that we would be able to directly engage with people who would describe themselves as far on the right, white supremacists, people who are using the Middle Ages as kind of a violent or intensely masculine ideal to emulate. And it's not impossible for us to engage with people like that. We don't feel that generally it's the most effective approach, the safest approach. And I'm happy to talk more about how we came to that conclusion and why we're focusing on things that we are. But I also would like to acknowledge the fact that we immediately recognized that there is already a lot of great scholarship in this space. There are already tons of scholars who had been working for many years at that point on modern uses of the Middle Ages, on the concept of medievalism, and had public outreach of various kinds. And really, we found that they weren't always successful in getting to a broader audience, sort of getting beyond people who are already inclined to read long history books or very in-depth investigative magazines. And so we were interested in how do we get to a public beyond.
Thanks, Robin. I have some follow-up questions, but before we get into those, Alice, Ben, what drew you to the toolkit?
Well, if I can start off, we both joined, I think, when Robin was doing a postdoctoral fellowship at Fordham, where I am a PhD candidate and Al was a master's student that time.
Yeah, I was a master's student in medieval studies.
So I was drawn to the toolkit specifically because, well, I had met Robin and we actually sort of had connections with each other because we both did a master's at Boston College, albeit different times. And I was drawn to it because as part of my work at Fordham, one of my fields in comps was about medievalism. And I was particularly interested in the more politicized side of things. I had focused on this in a public-facing article that I wrote with a colleague a couple years prior. And so I was very interested in the reading group that Robin started at Fordham while she was here. And we're recording from Fordham today. And towards the end of the semester, when Robin was going to be leaving for her new job, she said, well, would anybody be interested in taking this on? And I think it was on Zoom. I raised my hand Zoom and said, I feel like I'm probably the person who has to do this as I've done the comms field. And I'm going to be here for a while because I still have to write the damn dissertation. So that was how I got into it.
Yeah, I also joined the same reading group that Ben's talked about that Robin was leading. I was really interested in the possibility of doing something public-facing with the work that I was doing. As an undergraduate, I volunteered with like an education nonprofit, and I was really hoping to find a space to do similar types of work within the field of medieval studies and trying to share what I was learning outside of the academy and to try to do more public-facing outreach work. So that's one thing that really got me excited about the toolkit, as well as the promise of a group of like-minded young scholars and graduate students who are really committed to doing anti-racist work and to undermining uses of the medieval that prop up white supremacy. It was something that I felt like was an ethical commitment I wanted to bring to the field into my work. So finding the toolkit as a program that was trying to unite both that interest in doing public serving work and work against white supremacist medievalisms was just a really wonderful find. And it was really exciting to get to join that my first year.
I'm picking up on something that the three of you have touched upon in your responses just now: the importance of organizing and community formation. You are all clearly thinking of community beyond the academy, beyond the gates of the ivory tower. So why do you think that it is important for us as trained specialists to be in conversation with publics beyond the academy?
One thing that has come up a lot in conversation is we want to be able to give stuff to the public because people love the Middle Ages. People are really interested in the Middle Ages. They come up in a variety of forms, whether that's in fantasy books and shows, whether that's in video games, whether that's in hobbyists like the Society for Creative Anachronism, historical weaponry. There are all of these different ways that people spend their time and their energy that engage with the Middle Ages. And they can offer so much to us as ways of experiencing a time and learning from a different perspective. And we want to be able to offer something back, and not just to a one-way relationship where we're giving facts or we're giving expertise and, you know, the public accepts it, but it's a mutualistic relationship where, you know, people can learn from our expertise and we can learn from other people's expertise, because we're all interested in the Middle Ages and learning more about this period or more about the ways this period has been refracted through time.
Al, if you don't mind me picking up on that, I think also that there's a responsibility that folks in the academy have to make information about the past, and as much as we can, up-to-date information and scholarship available and publicly accessible to people. Because so many of these trends that focus on the past as a space of white supremacy, of the triumph of Western civilization, oftentimes they are riffing on older scholarship that is in the public domain from the 19th century or earlier that is widely accessible. And if you are someone who has a genuine interest in the Middle Ages, but only has access to what they can find on Google Books, it may be easier for you to fall into those pitfalls. And so I think that's a responsibility that we need to take seriously.
I agree with everything you guys have already said. I wanted to add that when we talk about misconceptions that we're correcting, and I would even tweak my use of the term correcting, it's not just about things that people mistakenly believe that are sort of obviously harmful. It's these really deeply ingrained beliefs about how the modern world is today, the things that we know, the liberties that we have, how those are positioned against the past in ways that can be extremely harmful. But it's also not so much about correcting as it is about modeling disagreement, showing how scholars are drawing information and drawing conclusions from the same material and disagreeing about it in ways that are productive. You know, not having one correct answer to everything, but then also carving out, here is a set of reasonable conclusions that we can draw from this material. And here are things that we don't think are reasonable conclusions because they're not well evidenced. So part of it is also just carrying that sense of critical thinking and argument building into public discourse.
This was something that really struck me when I first started coming to toolkit meetings, was the fact that this is what is meant in toolkit. It's not just a toolkit of facts or ideas. It's a toolkit of methods and the importance of teaching a historical methodology through these, you know, disputed or misused elements of the past is really important to the mission of the toolkit. It's not just telling people what to know, but trying to guide people into learning how to know in a different way, into having these more rigorous methodologies for making arguments and coming to believe things about the past.
Actually, I have a question for Alice, because I think you are uniquely positioned to answer this. Why do you think it's important to be doing this work as a graduate student?
For me, in part, it's because, you know, this is hopefully the start of my career. And I think doing this work straight from the beginning will be a lot easier than perhaps going a more traditional or restrictive route and then opening back up to it. And another part, I think, you know, myself, my friends, my cohort, we're all very strongly concerned about the things that are going on in the world, about the political and social and economic and climatic injustices that we face. And it feels like a real ethical imperative to try to bring this work into scholarship as we make these big, you know, life choices to do a PhD program and dedicate several years to doing this research. The question is, how do we think this is going to help people in a way that other work wouldn't be able to? Doing something with the Middle Ages that can be helpful to other people and that can be interesting or informative to other people who aren't already in this space is a really positive way to start approaching the rest of the work I want to do.
That is very well said, Alice. I think that something people don't realize enough is how transferable the skills we cultivate in the humanities are. But when we change our assumptions and start asking from an early stage, how does this research question matter beyond my personal curiosity? How can this knowledge serve as a public good, maybe? When we think about training and professionalization in these broader sense, we make it evident that medievalist grad students make for competitive candidates for jobs well beyond the professoriate. And I don't mean this as a palliative response to a narrowing job market. If anything, I think it is an ethical response because not all graduate students pursuing an advanced degree related to medieval studies want a traditional academic job.
That's such a fantastic point. You know, Ben and I are both graduate students at slightly different stages in the process, but I started working with the toolkit as a master's student. And I know many of the grad students in Ben's reading group are also masters. All of us may not continue into PhD programs, and the types of writing, the types of thinking and engaging and making space for conversation that we can practice through doing work like the toolkit is really valuable for a variety of careers. And the toolkits, you know, short form writing, short form articles and glossary entries that are available can be a great way to really refine writing skills that are broadly transferable in a range of public facing writing. So it's particularly valuable, I think, for master's students who can sometimes get displaced or pushed out of a lot of conversations about graduate students to be able to be involved in this work. And that's why it was very meaningful to have the opportunity to engage with this group as a master's student and to see the ongoing reading group and programming that encourages graduate students of all sorts to take part.
Could you talk to us a bit more about the kind of work the toolkit does?
So from the graduate level perspective, the toolkit reading group at Fordham, that we hope that other people will take the opportunity to maybe start at their own universities and reach out to us. And I'll provide a list of the readings that we did and the schedule that we had for last semester as accessory material for this podcast. What we effectively do is that we meet up every week, and usually we'll talk about a piece of writing about medievalisms. You know, I'll oftentimes start them with something like the C.M. Lomuto article that we talked about. I'll start them with Dreaming the Middle Ages by Umberto Eco. And then we'll talk through the various ways in which the medieval has been reimagined and the way that we can make an intervention as scholars to try and productively engage with this. And the goal is that by the end of the semester, by the end of the year, we'll work together with the various members of the reading group to put together some writing projects, either short-term glossary entries or longer articles. We're kind of switching that up this year. I'm hoping to do something a little bit more collaborative, but I'll ping to Alice to continue talking about the writing.
So right now on the Medievalist Toolkit's website, which is, I think, just medievalisttoolkit.org, one word, you can go up to the top right corner to the tools section, and you can see some of the writing that's already available on the website. Like we've mentioned, we've got the glossary entries, which are really short, I think usually under 300 words, just a description of a medieval term, place, event that has become contentious or has had a focused popular use that people have encountered. So the glossary entries prioritize words that any writers have actually encountered in non-medieval studies spaces. So, for example, one of them is 1199 Acre and Charles Martel, which came out of those events and people being used in white supremacist manifestos. So providing a quick, short burst of contextualization for anyone who wants to have a more informed perspective. We've also got articles, which are much longer form, still public facing and less formal than an academic article that can be on any range of issues, thinking about misperceptions of the Middle Ages or providing a more well-rounded and inclusive approach to the Middle Ages.
Yeah, the articles are taking a more complex issue and thinking through it in a context as opposed to the glossary entries, which are really meant to be kind of broadly applicable. So we have a piece that's coming out about samurai and the historical impressions of samurai at various points. We've done pieces before on medieval science and understandings of East-West collaboration between them. I would also add, in terms of our other activities that we're doing, we have an education initiative where we are putting together syllabi and modules for K-12 educators. We have a couple different versions of an undergrad class syllabus in medievalisms slash a sort of alternate version of Intro to the Middle Ages. And otherwise, we run public events that promote conversation between scholars and the general public on topics of medieval interest.
What you have all been saying aligns well with the principles of public humanities as a critical framework that is, at its core, committed to social justice. And as you mentioned earlier, Robin, the toolkit is not the only initiative of this kind, which is honestly exciting. So I'd like to engage in a thought exercise with you. In an earlier interview this year, my colleague Will Beattie asked Roland Betancourt and Carla Mallette to imagine the future of medieval studies in 100 years. So as you let your imaginations fly, who is talking about the Middle Ages in 100 years? Who is participating in the conversation?
I'm so glad you asked this because I remember hearing Will ask that question. I was like, huh, that is a great thought. Honestly, the first thing that comes to mind is, in comparison to today, seeing a much more global body of scholars, having an understanding of medieval that is a time period and not a place. And second, a definition of scholars that is inclusive of people who read about this or people who engage with it. I think if you look at the landscape of medieval studies as it exists digitally, which is a much broader space than sort of traditional academia, there are so many people who are reading scholarly articles that are available open access and consuming that information without the structure and the framework that scholars are trained in, and without the other scholarship that these articles exist in conversation with. But they're doing everything they can with that material. They are studying it deeply, they're learning it, they're thinking critically about it. A lot of them are doing experimental archaeology with it, reconstruction projects, and that is real, genuine work in our field. There is not currently a really established place for those scholar practitioners to engage with traditional academia. I think that has to be one of the first things that we're breaking down barriers towards. And we're not by any means the only ones doing this. There was a great project this past year, the Making Historical Dress Project, that did exactly this. And they went out of their way to bring in scholar practitioners and just practitioners, generally amateurs, for this, because they recognized all of the reconstruction work that's being done in history of fashion and history of textiles.
Yeah, I completely agree, Robin. There's so much to be learned from the hobbyist or amateur community, however you want to frame that. I also think if we're going complete blue sky situation here, more K-12 education about the Middle Ages in an American context, where we oftentimes don't get a robust introduction to that. after, I mean, for me, it was like sixth grade, I think. I think that would be, you know, that would be an amazing world for me to live in at the ripe old age of what? 132?
In that vein, I have two little kids. And when I go to museums, I always look in the bookshop for medieval books for them. And I'm shocked that medieval books for kids have not changed at all. Certainly since I was a kid, still just knights and castles, and not even different stories about knights and castles. So yeah, very much education.
In a recent article, Sierra Lomuto talks about the crisis of medieval studies. And I think that there is a clear connection between this crisis and the things you all are saying. A fundamental issue is the shrinking academic job market, with those who are fortunate enough to land a job being asked to do more and more every year. So, the usual suspects that we would be counting on Robin to revise those books and write new ones are fewer and fewer. We really need to shift the configuration of the field in a way that allows more people to participate in processes of knowledge production and communication. For instance, what can we do to help or encourage medievalists working beyond the academy to remain engaged? Sometimes it is not a lack of time or desire to do so, but an absence of resources, with most publications hidden behind paywalls. Although the landscape is shifting, we still don't have enough open access resources. So it is certainly exciting to envision a future for the field in which more people are participating and their contributions are recognized. There is real intelligence behind many of these projects, and I think that initiatives like the Toolkit are going to be vital moving forward to create this more welcoming space. On a related note, you've all mentioned medievalisms. In her book, The Shock of Medievalism, Kathleen Biddick explains how the distinction made between medieval studies as an academic field of inquiry and medievalism as that which falls under popular culture was a deliberate decision by the founders of the field in the 19th century. So, shall we talk about medievalisms and how our thinking of them has shifted since the 19th century?
So, medievalisms, as you mentioned, there is this breaking point in the 19th century with the scholars who really made the field what it is, made a sort of scientific approach to scholarship that break away from the more sort of romantic understanding of the Middle Ages that predominated in the pop culture of the 19th century. The understanding that I think we deal with largely when we talk about medievalisms today is that it refers to a popular understanding of the Middle Ages expressed oftentimes among lay people and usually pervading the popular culture that we're all very familiar with. You know, the model that I think I refer back to very frequently when I think about medievalisms in the world today is the one that Andrew B.R. Elliott puts forward in his book on digital medievalisms, that there's this sense of the Middle Ages that sort of suffuses and surrounds you as a person going through the world today that is baked into our culture that we kind of can't get rid of and that we think we know something about even if we've never taken a class on medieval history, where we might get some of that context and understanding and historiography that organizations like the Toolkit try and inject into this. And how that intersects with the goals of the Toolkit to create kind of depoliticized information about the past is that much of the medievalisms of the 19th century, and very much going into the professional study of the past, was built around imperialist projects, state-building projects that held up a certain view and vision of Western civilization and of the individual nations where these historians were writing that today reads to us as being sort of isolationist and narrow in scope in ways that limit our understanding and that we're still grappling with, like that wonderful Sierra Lomuto article that you referenced earlier makes the case for.
I think one of the kind of interesting things about medievalism is that it is so much history squished on top of itself because we are dealing with perceptions of a particular time period, but then we are dealing with how those perceptions exist in the 19th century, which gets to kind of define the medieval in terms of, you know, what's included, how we think about it, you know, its characteristics. And then we have like the revival of that 19th century medievalism in throughout the mid-20th century. It's a interwar period reference point and callback. It's a mid-century callback in literature and art and fashion. I mean, it is all over the place. And now we have the revival of the revival of the revival. We have this evergreen interest in material like Lord of the Rings that kind of keeps the medieval as a piece of vocabulary that we use in internet speak. The medieval is baked into digital communication now because it is such a reference point and I think a very complex one for people who are operating online. But then we also have the politicized Middle Ages and what it seems to represent to people in terms of gender roles, in terms of race, class divisions, what a state is. So it's a lot of processing these different eras of history all through each other and then spitting that out into the current moment.
I think what Robin alludes to in compressing all of these different periods and physical spaces of history is really the lack of nuance that you can encounter when you're engaging with a medievalism, which sometimes can be done very intentionally and with great specificity, but often are just invoking some larger idea of the Middle Ages. You see this a lot in spatial medievalism, so neo-Gothic or neo-Romanesque architecture, for example, that is evoking this idea of a medieval cathedral or a medieval castle, some large building of power, but that doesn't always have specific reference point to a particular, century or building. That's just drawing these ideas up in order to affect prestige and to create cultural longevity in this sense of cultural belonging with a European past. So these medievalisms can compress history and then they can kind of smush it around as well to create those types of narratives that give groups in the present a sense of unbroken linkage with a particular idea of the past.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that is important to stress is, as Umberto Eco pointed out a long time ago, it's not just a medievalism, it's medievalisms, as you mentioned, Alice. There's this sense in which the Middle Ages is this historical time period that can mean many things for many different people. And it's constantly iterated upon and reimagined. It's mutable in all of these different ways. And you can depict the same thing with wildly different interpretations. You can have the Clive Owen King Arthur standing alongside Richard Harrison Camelot, standing alongside Charlie Hunnam in Guy Ritchie's imagination of it. And all of these things are interpretations of the past that have wildly different expectations that come along with them and carry these different associations for the people who are absorbing them.
Medievalism also doesn't have to be about the real Middle Ages at all. I think a place where we get caught in scholarship is that it's only medievalism if it's actually referring to something medieval. But a lot of the time, casual medievalisms are referring to things that evoke the same sense of historicity. They're not actually medieval. They might be 19th century, but they feel medieval because they feel technologically, unadvanced, or they feel barbaric or violent in a way that we associate with the Middle Ages. It's a feeling, it's a sense, it's not just the historical period or our understanding of the historical period.
To shift gears a bit, the term medieval is often used derogatorily in political discourse. How was that word, in your opinion, received by audiences hearing it?
This is a question I ask my students basically every semester, so it's great to be on the other end of it. I didn't realize how much pressure I was putting on them, though. I mean, I think the most basic answer in some ways is that it conveys for a lot of people that very easy catch-all of barbaric, regressive, backwards, bad, that was built out in the early modern period to refer to the Middle Ages.
In contemporary usage, a lot of the time you'll see medieval used specifically about gender roles. So if politicians are calling a place medieval, often that'll have something to do with the way that women are being treated or what women's rights are in that era. I think you've seen this both from conservative politicians as well as after the downfall of Roe v. Wade, with some liberal and left-leaning politicians calling it medieval, which is a total flattening of the very contentious issue of medieval abortion. But it's often centered on perceived ideas of women's standing in the Middle Ages and what traditional, quote unquote, gender roles would have been.
To be sure, the term medieval is quite charged rhetorically because it is underwritten by a linear narrative of Western progress, quote unquote. When you refer to gender dynamics as medieval, to use your example, Alice, you push your audience to think, oh, look how far we've come. We've left all of those barbaric practices behind. Look how well we treat women today. When the reality is that we are not there yet. Pay disparity between genders remains a sad reality. Many women are denied autonomy over their own bodies. So, to use the term medieval, I think, helps make your audience complacent and adapt this mindset of, we are better than we were before, so let's keep our heads down and move along.
I think that progress narrative is exactly it. We see it in every aspect of how we use the term medieval. We think about it in terms of medicine, life expectancy. I hear that one all the time. We talk about it in terms of women's position in society, gender roles, law. I mean, everything is, we're only getting better. And so we must be better off now than we were before. And to go back to something Alice said earlier, it prompts us to think in a very simplistic way about the state of all of these things. You know, there isn't just one standard of equality. We are not all equal now, but even if we were, there are so many ways that we could be equal. It's not just about who has the right to vote, right? We have all of these social issues that we break down in terms of things like access or representation. Those are very complex issues, and we can't simplify them by saying, well, we are more advanced in these things than we were before. There are examples from the Middle Ages where people who are disenfranchised now or disadvantaged now had more space to operate in their societies, but they still did not have the same rights. They were certainly not equal, but potentially they had more options.
To pursue this thread of gender a little further, Ben, I see that you have an interest in questions of masculinity. Do you see any connection in the ways that the medieval is invoked in public discourse and contemporary notions of masculinity?
Yeah, the thing that I was immediately interested in when we started doing the reading group at Fordham was to puzzle out how medievalisms are applied by folks who are relying on a particularly masculine approach to understanding the Middle Ages. A lot of what I've focused on, and in a way this is still early days, I'm still very far away from publishing something about this, is that I've been trying to look at the ways in which medievalisms have been used by certain aspects of the culture and society to marshal particular ideas about masculinity that are useful for their political goals. You know, to use an example from the newly appointed Secretary of Defense, when talking about his goals, one thing that he called to mind was bringing back a warrior mindset to the United States. And this is a man who has a Jerusalem cross tattoo, who has a Deus Vult tattoo. This is one of the many ways in which we see individuals marshaling these kinds of narratives and these examples of men or masculinities from the past for their own purposes. And they're drawing on a very limited understanding of masculinity, right? They're drawing on usually warrior masculinities that they pull from the Middle Ages, but also from the classical world, to push for a kind of reimagining of the modern model man. For example, there's a very popular Instagram account, has hundreds of thousands of followers. It's called Trad West. It's on a bunch of different platforms. One of the things that they will routinely do is that they will juxtapose an imagined understanding of a medieval man, usually from a very Christian context, because it's a very Christian account. And they'll juxtapose a sort of virile man from the past with a, from their perspective, soft and weak and effeminate man from the present, and try to create this narrative of decline in the modern era. It's kind of the reverse of the trope that we just talked about, that we have people who deal with the medieval as something to be contrasted with the present in a positive way, but also in a negative way. That this history, oftentimes baked in a history of Western culture and white supremacy, is something to be reclaimed and to be called back to with sometimes violent connotations. To throw in another random example, just before this, I was trolling through Twitter or X or whatever I'm supposed to call it these days, and one of the accounts that I saw just using the phrase medieval, or I think it was using the phrase knight, was an account called Medieval Moment or Medieval Memory. And they were getting into a sort of argument with some of their followers. This is not a big account, but some of their followers about a book that they had pointed out that was focused on providing lessons from the past. And they said, the point of studying history is not to learn lessons. And somebody, of course, asked them, what is the point of studying history? And they said, the point of studying history is to meet or surpass the achievements of your ancestors. And I thought, now that's a dog whistle if I've ever heard one. The expressions going on the video chat here are incredible.
Well, that's a lot to take in. Well, I process what Ben just said. Robin, to quote Alice's turn of phrase, you are interested in femininity and medico-magical medievalisms. Talk to us about that and how this appeal to the past helps frame some of the contemporary practices you study.
I won't argue with Alice's phrasing there. I think that was pretty good. A lot of what Ben and I are independently looking at exists in online spaces. It exists in other spaces too, but it is so much more condensed and obvious on the internet. So this for me is a convergence of research I am doing in medieval medicine and historical herbal traditions in general. And that space in a scholarly sense already is very feminized. There has been an interest in that for a long time in terms of what herbal traditions can say about women's medical practices. That fact has really been picked up by herbal practitioners who are not medievalist scholars. There's a huge trend in modern herbal practice, and this is one of the places where people have access to bits of medievalist scholarship and are kind of folding that into other educations that they have on the subject. That side of things is on a sliding scale with witchcraft, and I don't mean historical witchcraft. I mean people who understand themselves right now to be practicing witchcraft. There is a huge range of that, from the modern religion of Wiccanism to people who are drawing on historical religious traditions in Judaism, in pre-Christian Nordic traditions, in Caribbean traditions. There's a very wide range of what people mean by witchcraft, but that always sort of goes along with herbalism. And there's a very feminist bent to it. Women taking control of their bodies and their medical care as empowerment. That has very obvious connotations and relevance to today, but it also often shares a space with the kind of trad wife trend. It is very easy, especially in algorithmic apps, if you are searching for material on witchcraft, herbalism, even things like cooking that are related to that, to very quickly start to get fed material on homesteading, trad wives, essentially a idealized so-called traditional mode of femininity that is based in women's domestic labor and takes exactly the opposite interpretation of that witchcraft herbalism material. They're looking at it in terms of, how can I go off the grid and feed my entire family alternatives to vaccines, modern medicine, food that has not been pasteurized or that is lacking in antibiotics and other additives, in the sense that this will perhaps protect me from the evil forces of the nanny state. Like, you know, a very, very conservative way of looking at things. What's really interesting to me about this is that there is such a bleed over between these two interpretations. They really do exist in the same space. And that fact in itself is well known by people who participate in any of this content. There's a tremendous amount of commentary on the fact that, oh, I was just looking for recipes for how to can jam, and I am being told like how to be subservient to my husband. That wasn't what I intended. All of these things operate on different kinds of medievalisms. It's associations with a pre-modern form of medicine, its ideas about witchcraft and what that means to people at different levels, its ideas about traditional femininity that are prompting both a positive association with that so-called traditional femininity and a negative association in terms of witchcraft. And, you know, that is kind of a feminist statement. It's really a whole range of things.
Both of your examples, Robin and Ben, are useful reminders that the medieval is circulating quite broadly and that people nowadays actively adapt their lives, for good or ill, to reflect the way in which they understand their connection to this past. To return to the toolkit as a mediator between the academy and the larger public, what do you think you need to sustain this kind of work? How can we reach wider audiences or new audiences?
I genuinely think that one thing that does make a big difference for dealing with this material and trying to do outreach to people is to teach, which is something that we as academics hopefully get to do. Robin, I know you've run entire classes based around the toolkit and its mission. I think exposing to graduate students to this material and to the ways in which medievalisms influence or can influence pedagogy and scholarship, I think doing that and getting more people aware of this is the first step in a much larger process. I mean, that's an answer for the 100 years down the road timeframe, but that's how I make myself feel better about things.
I think it boils down to conversations, just much more communication. And I mean this on so many levels. I think on the academic side, medievalists need to be having more conversations with our colleagues in other disciplines, whether that's in who work in other time periods where the Middle Ages are a reference point, so that other scholars are also focusing on this as a piece of vocabulary. What would American history look like if American historians were also thinking about or equipped to think about how the Middle Ages are being used in our history? I feel like our default is to talk about what K-12 educators should and shouldn't be doing. And I think they have enough on their plates. We should be thinking about how we can support them. And that is something that we're doing, trying to create open access resources that they can use to easily integrate medieval materials into their classes. But it is really a conversation. Anything that facilitates us listening to how other people are actually using the Middle Ages or how they want to use it, and offering ourselves as not just experts, but as people who can reflect on that. You know, we're not just providing an answer, we're asking other questions that are useful to other people. In video games, for instance, I don't think it's occurred to a lot of the people who are designing video games that they're presenting material in a way that we find problematic, or that there are even other options. I think if you ask a medievalist, like, what would you like to see in a medieval-inspired video game, you get some really interesting answers. You get a lot more than historical battle simulator, which is kind of the default. We're not involved in that creative process, and we could be. We don't need to be in control of everything that we put out there. We don't need to be making our own historical video games, but we do need to be in conversation with the people who are. In the same way, we can dip our toes into social media and digital media more broadly, but we're not experts in that. And we can collaborate with people who are and who really know what they're doing in those areas.
Speaking of conversations, Robin, would you want to talk about the Seattle event and how that's kind of designed to hopefully engender some of these conversations that we'd really like to be having?
Yeah. So I teach at Seattle University, and Seattle, like many cities, has a pretty interesting, varied, vibrant medievalist scene. So we put together an event in Seattle that is drawing together kind of hobbyists from a bunch of different groups, hopefully some people who work in the gaming industry, because there's quite a bit of gaming industry in Seattle, as well as people who do early music, historical costuming, Society for Creative Anachronisms. We'll see if we get some battle reenactors or historical martial arts folks in there as well, potentially the metal scene. And the place that we're hosting this is the National Nordic Museum. And I just need to talk them up. I think it's a great institution. They really have a unique balance of being a cultural heritage museum that is looking at the past and thinking very carefully about how they are presenting the past of a specific geographical region, but they are also an art museum in a sense. They put on exhibitions of current living artists, much more recent history. They are a cultural institution that is hosting public events on Nordic celebrations of things like Christmas or spring festivals. And I think that the way that they thread that needle is excellent and should be emulated by other people. And I think even just in the nuance of how they describe what they cover, what's in their purview, they don't describe themselves as the Scandinavian Heritage Museum. They are intentionally focusing on the geographical region so that they can be much more inclusive and promote a much more inclusive understanding of who's part of that history and what they want people to do with it. They say explicitly in their materials that they are not promoting Nordic heritage as something that is above anyone else. It's simply one particular heritage that happens to be very well represented in the Pacific Northwest. So we're doing this event in connection with them. We're also doing a undergraduate research conference as part of that that we're hosting at Seattle U. And this is meant to just provide a lot of conversation to think about how do we draw positive inspiration from the medieval past? How do we use that to build inclusive spaces? I do want to say one final thing. We are always happy to welcome new people into the group. This is not a closed group by any means. So graduate students, even if you don't know what you would contribute, but you're interested in this material or you're interested in getting a sort of supplemental education in medievalism, we would especially welcome grad students, advanced undergrads, independent scholars, people who are just hobbyists who stumbled upon this podcast for other reasons. We welcome more members.
Thanks again for joining us today, Alice, Ben, Robin. I, for one, am very excited to follow along with the work of the Medievalist Toolkit.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is really great.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 4 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, Logan Quigley, and me, Lauren Lee, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with the latest episodes. Thanks for listening.